duties, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt addressed the nation through a series of radio broadcasts known as the Fireside Chats. His aim was to reassure the common man that our society would recover from its troubled times. But we're far from 1930, and I deal with a different kind of far. For a new era of worldly frustration, we offer a fresh conversation. I'm Greg Carlwood, and these are the Fireside Chats.
Here we go, our side chatters. Welcome to the party. Drink a little drink, smoking a little smoke, the only way I know how, from sunny San Diego. I'm Greg Carlwood, and today we're popping open the sweet, sweet Pandora's box of conspiracy goodness by looking at a lot of the secret programs that have been going on over the last few decades, why they've happened, what's the connection, and what do we know about them? Things like geoengineering, chemtrails, the construction of a vast network of underground bases and high-tech tube trains, depopulation, the Georgia Guidestones, Agenda 21, Raven Rock, UFOs, secret space programs, and more. And that's just in the first hour. As you folks know, each episode has an extended second hour, and this one's no different. If you enjoy it and want to hear more about these topics and other areas of interest, like the prospect of space Nazis, definitely support the show for $5 a month or $60 a year by joining THC Plus at thehiresidechatsplus.com, and I'll support you with an extra hour each show. But it's been a while since we've done an episode that focused on the mainstream conspiracy world, and maybe we've been a little bit overdue. So let's dive straight into the madness. No time to waste. Thanks everyone for listening and supporting this wild ride around the fringe. Keep your seat backs and tray tables in the upright locked position, because we're taking off with my good friend and conspiracy guru, Olav Phillips.
When I find myself in times of trouble, Mr. Carlwood comes to me, speaking words of wisdom, THC. THC, 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 THC. Speaking words of wisdom, THC.
All right, people, if you ask me, the biggest conspiratorial can of worms is the topic of secret technologies that have been hidden from the masses, and you don't have to travel very far down that road before you encounter stories of reverse engineering UFOs, secret underground facilities, moon bases, Mars bases, covert pacts with the Greys, geoengineering, breakaway civilizations, and the whole grab bag of conspiracy goodness. And I'm sure we'll touch on all those things as we try to figure out just how far some of these hidden technologies and covert projects have gone, where they came from, and to what ends are these mysterious men working towards. And I can think of no better guest to give us the good word than my main man, Olav Phillips, founder of the Anomalies Network, lifelong space technology enthusiast, and a grade-A conspiracy researcher, hot off the presses with a great new book entitled The Secret Space Age, Secret Space Programs, Breakaway Civilizations, Nazi UFOs, SDI, and Alternative 3. Here he is, the man who knows the plan, Olav Phillips. How the hell are you?
I'm doing all right. How are you?
I'm great, man. Never better. It is always a pleasure getting into this stuff with you. I really love the book. It expands on so many awesome areas where you find at least a couple new pieces of information or connections I hadn't heard before. So I think this is going to be a pretty good time. Before we really get into the book, I have been really anxious to ask you about your trip to the Eseti Ranch. We had James Gilliland on the show a while back talking about the strange UFO sightings they have up there, and I'm actually planning a trip to go up in October, and I figured that'd be my best chance to see something weird in the sky, you know, because I'm dying to do that. But how'd it go for you, man?
That's a very strange place. That's a very bizarre place, I gotta tell you.
Yeah,
it's you know, I'm a nuts and bolts kind of conspiracy nut. So, you know, for me, you know, when I see weird stuff streaking across the sky, you know, the first thing I'm doing is I'm figuring out, is it human?
Mm-hmm.
I guess that's the premise of the book, right?
Right.
But I saw things up there that I'm pretty convinced were exotic aircraft.
Okay.
I saw a few things up there that I don't know what it was.
Huh.
I'm fairly certain that I saw an aurora.
Oh, right on. That'd be cool.
Yeah. And the one thing that really boggles my mind that I haven't – well, there are two things that boggled my mind when I was up there that I really can't explain is that there's this weird light that shows up above the tree line on the mountain. And Mount Adams is very high. I think it's like 14,000 feet. So you're talking 10 – 10, 11,000 feet up, there's a light, a very bright light, and I'm 14 miles away, right?
Okay.
And it was the size of maybe a penny, and it to me, and it would just be there, and then it would close and open and close and open and close, you know, every so often. I don't know what that was.
Yeah, that is strange. And what's this stuff I saw on Facebook about a possible Bigfoot sighting up there too?
So I'm sitting, it's the afternoon, and one thing that you have to prepare for when you go up there is during the day, there's not a whole lot to do.
Yeah.
Right? You pretty much just hang out. All the fun happens at night.
I get that.
Yeah. And I'm sitting at a table with Larry Overman, the guy from Ghost Mine, the haunted miner. And I'm sitting there with him, and I'm checking my email on my phone. And that's another weird thing about that place, but I'll get to that in a minute. I'm checking my email on my phone, and he starts nudging me. He's all, look at that, look at that. And I'm like, Larry, leave me alone. I'm looking at my email. So no, look at this. And he starts elbowing me. And finally I look up, and there's an ice field that's at about a 45 degree angle on the side of the mountain. And again, I'm 14 miles away, and it's a good 12,000 feet in the air. Right. So when you're looking at it, trees are awful small. And basically, I finally found what he was looking at. Basically, what it was two black shapes. They were lines, like people.
Mm-hmm.
And they're staggered a couple inches apart. One is higher, one is lower. And they're basically going up the side of the mountain.
Whoa.
Yeah. And at that distance, I couldn't see a person.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Because, you know, if you were hiking up the mountain, you would look like a little dot.
Yeah. Like nothing from that far away.
But this was maybe a quarter of an inch high. I mean, it was clear. I could actually see them compressing like they were walking.
Whoa, man. That is awesome. I got to get up there. That just sounds too crazy. You're getting the whole plethora, the whole Pandora's box of things you want to see in the woods, and you're seeing it all right there. I mean, they should be charging a hefty fee for that. I mean, that's better than Universal Studios.
It is. I mean, and we watched it for 45 minutes while these two little lines moved up the side of the mountain, and they finally got to a crest. I think there's a depression behind it. There's like a little, like a lip before you start the final ascent toward the peak. And when they got there, I could actually see them standing. I could see them against the cliff behind them.
Man.
Yeah. And you know, we were trying to do some napkin math, and I have to be honest, I'm not the greatest mathematician in the world. I was a social sciences major. Liberal arts. Yay.
At least you got a major in something.
You got to major in something. Anthro seemed to fit the bill at the time. But I, you know, I was trying to do some napkin math to figure out how big they were. And Larry and I came to the conclusion we think they were maybe 8 to 10 feet tall.
Whoa.
Yeah. And so, you know, to watch two things that are 8 to 10 feet tall hike up the side of a snowfield that's a 45 degree angle, you know, that's at 14 miles to see it, the you know, maybe a quarter of an inch high. That's pretty damn impressive.
Yeah.
I mean, it was the size of trees, like little trees. Yeah.
That is so cool.
I honestly, I couldn't tell you if it was Bigfoot or not. The only thing I can come up with is Bigfoot.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't a person.
Crazy, man. That's interesting. Did you see more than just that one light in the sky? Did you see other things you just would probably consider them to be crafts you can identify? Because if people don't know, you have a huge interest in those type of, you know, high-tech aircrafts or experimental aircrafts. So, you know, if you say you saw something that you couldn't explain, I mean, that to me has more clout than the average person.
I saw some things that I couldn't explain. Their behavior was odd. It kind of fell this way, that things that we saw flying out of the southwest, I mean, southeast toward the north, northwest, they tended to be what I would classify as experimental aircraft, or exotic aircraft is probably more accurate, except for the Aurora. What I think was an Aurora, that went east to west. Now, the stuff that came in from the west, or came in from the north, or came in straight from the east, that stuff behaved a little more interestingly. They were making a lot of weird turns, and it was this weird behavior. It's like if a pilot was flying that, you know, you'd have to wonder if they were on something, because they were weaving and doing zigzags and all kinds of strange stuff. And, it, you know, if I was a pilot, you know, maybe for fun, I'd do that stuff. But at the altitude we're talking about, you know, and the speed that we're talking about, it would be very tough to control the aircraft.
Yeah.
But I definitely saw the Aurora, and that was odd. And we saw a set of aircraft that were roughly, it was very hard to tell because they were very high. And even using binoculars, it was very difficult to determine their shape. But they looked kind of like stars that would fade in and fade out.
Huh.
Yeah. And we were able to illuminate on, I think, six separate occasions. We were able to actually illuminate the aircraft. And what's weird is that when we illuminated the aircraft, right?
Yeah.
When you hit it with a light, you expect the light to kind of like bounce off of it and to reflect. That's not what happened. When we illuminated it, what it did is it actually absorbed it.
Whoa.
And when it absorbed the light, it actually wrapped it around the fuselage.
Weird.
So you could kind of tell in that second, you could see it diffuse around the fuselage. And after that would happen, the light would turn off. The kind of light we could see, which was fading in and fading out, it would actually shut off, and it would just be blacker than black. I mean, think of the most darkest black thing you can, and it was blacker than that. It was actually blacker than the sky.
Wow, that's interesting.
And then it just took off. It was like, bam, gone.
Jesus, man. God, I would love to see some stuff like that. I'm even more psyched to go up there.
Well, what I think was happening is that there's a type of aircraft that is a kind of triangular wedge shape, and what it has is it has supposedly has a kind of camera or something that looks ahead as it's flying, and it projects the star field below it. And if you see it fly at lower altitude, you'll see basically this kind of shape, and like a moving star field. And because it's projecting this star field, right, it'll shimmer a little bit. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what we were seeing. I think the fading was it actually capturing the stars above it and projecting it on the belly of the aircraft.
Whoa, man.
And I think when we illuminated it, it set off something inside the aircraft. And the guy said, you know, the pilot, man, woman, whatever, the pilot was like, oh, something can see me. That's not good. And flicked a switch and turned it off. And then it was like, I'm just going to leave, and just took off.
Wow.
We did six separate times we did that.
Wow.
Now, a lot of people would identify that as a UFO, you know, but in our case, I think both Larry and I and some others, you know, we came to the conclusion that they were aircraft.
Yeah.
But they had to be at about 70,000 feet plus.
That's still cool. I mean, and a part of me is so sad that I missed the UFO glory days, because now I hardly ever even look at UFO videos, because CGI and conventional crafts and drones are just so far advanced. That shit could be anything, you know? It just doesn't carry the same weight as a weird sighting would in the 40s or 50s.
Well, even in the 80s, I mean, when I was a kid in the 80s, I was outside my parents' house, and I actually saw what looked astonishingly like a Lazar Sportster hanging in the sky at about 25,000 feet.
Huh.
I mean, it had the wave guide, the whole thing. It just hung there.
Damn.
Yeah, and then when I was in college, I went to Davis, UC Davis, and the handyman for our apartment complex, he was a bit of a UFO nut. and he lived in Dixon, which is the next town down from us. You would go through Dixon to get to Davis. And they had a mass UFO sighting the night before, and they, like, the entire police force of Dixon, it's not a huge town, but the entire police force had gotten woken up, and they were all out there chasing a cigar-shaped UFO that was running parallel to these train tracks. And so he gave me the article. He's like, you know, you should go check it out. So my girlfriend and I, who's my wife now, we got in the car,
yeah.
No cameras, no, you know, camcorders, no nothing. Because, you know, she kept saying, well, don't you want to bring a camera or something? I said, no, I'm not going to see anything, right?
Yeah.
And so we go down the road, and we parked in a cornfield. Great place to park, right?
Mm-hmm.
We parked in a cornfield. It's like a bad science fiction movie.
Yeah, it's like Signs.
Right. We parked in a cornfield, and we were sitting there for a little while, and then these lights started to move in the sky, and we thought they were satellites at first, but it was like a dogfight. The only way I could describe it, they were doing circles around each other, making triangles and doing high speed 90 degree turns and all kinds of strange stuff. And then two of them came down, and there are these two radio masts that are probably, I don't know, 15 miles apart, 10, 15 mm-hmm. miles apart. And they were flying between the radio masts, and they would go down to one end and roll over, come back, roll over, go down, roll over, come back, roll over. And when they rolled over, you could see that they were triangular shaped.
Wow.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, this sightings are out there. You have to go to somewhere where you're going to mm-hmm. see one.
And
apparently Mount Adams is
right.
There.
I mean, you're not the only one to say that. It seems like a definite hotbed. So I am psyched. And who knows what these things are? I mean, for the people at home who might not be as familiar, your position is that most of these crafts are human, which is not really that controversial of a stance to take. But a lot of people think we have this technology today, but that it did come from reverse engineered crafts like the crash at Roswell or a secret deal with the Greys for technology in exchange for permission to carry out abductions. And I'm curious what you think about that. I mean, are these technological advancements just the product of human ingenuity that seems futuristic because they've been hidden from us? Or could there have been an alien component at some point that propelled us forward?
Well, that's hard to right. say. I mean, that's a lot of speculation because it's possible. It's possible that something crashed at Roswell or crashed at Kingman or, you know, a couple of other places where stuff has crashed. Ruben Uriarte did a great book with Noe Torres where the Mexican Roswell where this, you know, UFO crashed and they carried across the border. You know, so it's possible that something crashed and we back engineered it. I mean, then you're going to get into the whole, you know, Bob Lazar thing. And I've been a strong supporter of Lazar. You know, since he came out. I mean, I was very young when Lazar came out. But, you know, since the first time I read his story and I talked to him, the guy, I will tell you, I sat across his desk from him. That man is absolutely telling you the truth. That he is absolutely telling you what he saw or what he believes he saw.
Wow.
So it is possible. The thing you have to remember, though, is that DARPA, where all this stuff comes from, you know, conservatively, they're 50 years ahead of us. More realistically, they're 100 years ahead of us in development.
Yeah, man. And I know on some forums I've seen that you take a little bit of flack for playing down the alien angle and saying that most of this is human technology or taking that position. But I mean, I think the idea that we have moon bases and Mars bases and troop transports and massive Starfleet ships going out there in secret, I mean, that's just as fascinating.
Well, you know, I think we do ourselves a disservice by constantly saying, okay, well, everything's just aliens.
Yeah. I'm not saying it's aliens, but it's aliens.
Right. I mean, we have some amazing engineers out there. And you know, sure, there's a schism in the community, you know, where if you think it's aliens, you're on this side. And if you don't, you're on that side. You know, I've seen stuff that I think was probably alien. I think, you know, maybe 10... What Hynek and Valley have always said, that it was like 10 or 15%.
I mean, that's crazy. If it's even 1%, you know, even if it's only happened one time, I mean, that's
what I say. If it's 1%, we got a problem.
Right. So it's like, you know, it's getting kind of nitpicky in the community of ufology arguing because, you know, you're not arguing 0%. So we're really talking about a real marginal thing. But yet some people get real upset. It's like a religion to them. It's like this stuff can't be human. It must be alien.
The thing that gets me, though, is that, you know, I do firmly believe that Solar Warden is out there.
Yeah.
And if we have moon bases and Mars bases and space fleets, you know, my hypothesis for why we have moon bases and Mars bases is one thing, but it doesn't explain necessarily a space fleet, mm-hmm. right? If you've got stuff that's floating around up there and it is like Solar Warden, you know, and we started to see the evidence of Solar Warden even before McKinnon with the whole SERPO thing, that, you know, whether you believe SERPO or not, one of the components of SERPO was this idea that we had, you know, extra, how should I put it? Well, I guess to be extraterrestrial, right? They're off the planet. We have stellar ships.
Off-world military astronauts.
Exactly. And then, you know, you look at Ben Rich, who is running the Skunk Works, you know, and he's made a series of very interesting statements, like stuff like, not only do I have the technology to take ET home, but I got the contract. I think he said that at Caltech.
Yeah, like, what's that about?
What's that about? Right. That's DARPA producing Solar Warden. And then you get these, like, every time you do a show, right, somebody calls in with something interesting. One time I was doing a show, and at the very end of the show, in the last 10 minutes of the show, old guy calls in from Washington State, right? And he's talking about this project that he worked on called Space Warden, which was a hunter-killer satellite SDI system. And he worked on this in the early 70s, you know, and it was down near LA somewhere, and they had federal agents protecting them. They had, you know, and it was very hush hush and secret. And this is 10 years before Reagan came out with Star Wars.
Yeah.
And he said, wow, it was operationalized by the time Reagan ever came up with the idea.
Man. Yeah, it's weird, and I love digging into this stuff to see how far it goes. But, I mean, let's kind of get into your book and do that. I mean, we've made mention of Alternative 3 before, but give us the cliff notes again, because we're going to use the Alternative 1-2-3 model to walk through some of these secret programs and see what maybe they could be for and how far they've gone. So what was Alternative 3 for those who missed that before?
So Alternative 3, at its most basic, was a mockumentary. Of a TV show. There was a TV show. It was a science show. And they decided for the final episode that they were going to air it on April 1st. And as an April Fool's joke, they would do something that was like a War of the Worlds, basic, mm-hmm. and scare the crap out of everybody. And basically they made a show that, well, I'll get to that in a second. So they were supposed to show it on April 1st, but they had a strike. It's England. They had a strike, scheduling conflicts, scheduling problems, and they ended up showing it, I think, in like June. And when they showed it, it went crazy, and the phones lit up, and everybody was agitated. And basically what the premise of the show was is that they started out looking at something called the brain drain. In the 1970s – oh, it was made in 77. In the 70s, a lot of scientists and technicians were leaving England because they could go to Germany and France and other places and make more money. Mm-hmm. So they were trying to ostensibly look at this problem. And what they actually discovered is that a bunch of these people were just straight disappearing, right? And then they decided, well, why are they disappearing? And what it came back as is that there was a top secret meeting in the late 50s. In the late 50s, they determined that we were going to suffer some sort of a catastrophic climate change. In the show, they talk about, you know, the things you'd expect, like droughts and high temperatures. But at the end of it, they kind of lean toward this idea of we're going back into an ice age. And so the planners came up with this idea that they would try to solve the problem. And they came up with three options. Alternative one was to blow a hole in the upper atmosphere using a nuclear weapon, mm-hmm. to vent the greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide, into space. Alternative two, and that failed. Alternative two was to build bunkers that people could live in. It's not really economically feasible. So alternative mm-hmm. three was to actually skip town and by way of the moon go to Mars and to set up shop on Mars and to wait for, you know, whatever climate damage was done to the Earth to fix itself and then to come home. So when you look at it as a structure, right, you can't deny that the TV show is fake. The music was done by Brian Eno. He's a great ambient electronica musician. The guy who wrote it, David Ambrose, he's a very famous writer. Christopher Miles, the guy who directed it and filmed it, became a very famous director in England. you know, I mean, the people, Shane Rimmer, who is the astronaut, who's the kind of Buzz Aldrin kind of astronaut. You know, he had been in a TV show called UFO and a bunch of others in that time period. He kind of bounced around as the archetyped American in these kind of British TV shows in the late 70s, early 80s. Mm-hmm. So you can't deny the show is fake. But if you look at it structurally, it actually very nicely aligns to a series of things that actually happened.
Exactly, because they were just pulling a prank, but it seems like there are some indications that they might have stumbled upon a real plan or something sensitive to the higher-ups, because didn't even one of them, didn't they have their Alternative 3 material or film stolen after the airing at some point?
So Christopher Miles, who filmed it, says that although they faked the whole thing and used a lot of stock photography, that he believes at this point that they came frighteningly close to something real.
Yeah.
And the guy that you're talking about is Leslie Watkins, who actually did the book treatment. And he, after writing the book, started to be contacted by people. And he was convinced that – I actually reproduced the letter in the book. But he was convinced that it was actually real. And he had set out to write a second book arguing that Alternative 3 was real. But – in the process of moving from England to Australia to New Zealand, somebody went into his cargo container and stole everything. Mm. And so after that, he basically dropped off the face of the earth. Outside of the one letter that I was able to find, I can find no way to contact him.
Interesting.
I'd love to talk to him.
Yeah. So, I mean, back then it might not have been as obvious, but today, I mean, we're going to talk about it, your book's about it, but as we go through the alternatives, I mean, a lot of these programs are pretty obvious to anyone who's in the alternative news community now. I mean, Alternative 1, blasting holes in the atmosphere, they tried to do that with something called Project Argus, right?
Right. It's Project Hardtack Argus, and basically that was a nuclear weapons test, and ostensibly they were trying to prove something called the Coriolis effect. And this guy had hypothesized that if you set off a nuclear weapon at high altitude, you could create an artificial Van Allen radiation belt. And they actually succeeded in doing that. But that program, that project, actually had a massive fleet associated with it. They organized it in maybe a third to a half the time or a third of the time that it normally took. So normally it took like anywhere from 1 to 2 years to plan a nuclear test. They did this in 6 months. In 6 months, they were launching the missile.
Huh.
And so apparently, you know, it fits everything. It's the highest nuclear test ever carried out. And one of the interesting things about it is that at the time, I think it was Time or Newsweek, one of the big news operations said that it was probably the most important scientific test ever carried out. That being said, they classified it until like 1982. So they carried it out like the late 50s, and they classified it until like 1982.
Wow. So they were successful in creating a fake Van Allen radiation belt, but as far as one of their other goals, which was blasting that hole in the upper atmosphere to release CO2 gases, I mean, that part was not successful, right?
Correct.
So you think Project Argus, in the book, you kind of say that you think it might have been a precursor to the chemtrails of today. Like that might be their second attempt at kind of doing the same thing, trying to manage the changing climate, right?
Right. So in the event that the Argus failed, they needed a backup. And I argue that geoengineering and chemtrails are that backup. I call it Alternative 1.5.
Yeah, man. And I mean, that's a pretty controversial thing to say, because people are going to think you're an agent of the New World Order coming on here and saying that chemtrails are good. But I mean, there is...
Well, I'm not saying they're good. Right, I'm just saying that's what they are.
Yeah.
You know, they're not mind control. They're not... It's a desperate attempt to control the atmosphere.
Yeah, and there might be some really negative side effects like Alzheimer's or things that, you know, I mean, cancer rates, who knows? I mean, we have so much poisonous stuff in our everyday life that who knows why people are getting sick and dying. But there is some pretty compelling evidence for this theory that chemtrails are trying to do this, maybe stave off the rising temperatures. That comes out of the aftermath of 9/11, right?
Right. So basically what happened was right after 9/11 happened, right, they grounded everything.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of atmospheric scientists at that time said, oh my God, they grounded everything. We've got to run some tests, right? Because this is the only chance we'll ever have to find, you know, to get these measurements, because we always have airplanes.
Yeah, very smart.
Right. So they go out and they start floating balloons. And what they found was that over the 6 days, the ambient temperature of the Earth increased by 1.8 degrees.
Wow.
And the overall, not only did the temperature increase, but the amount of light making it down to the surface exponentially increased. And so they came up with this buzzword for it called global dimming. And so the idea is that by dumping this stuff in the upper atmosphere. And you have to remember, this is a project that started in the 60s, right?
Mm-hmm.
By dumping stuff in the atmosphere, they change the reflectivity of the Earth, the albedo of the Earth, and they're kind of reflecting the sunlight off into space. And it's never reaching the surface of the Earth, which keeps the temperature artificially low. So they can try to control it by using geoengineering. And the more you look at it, you start to see a lot of really interesting things coming out of it. You know, there are a series of patents that were filed by a number of people, including Hughes Aircraft in 1990. They filed a patent for something they call the Welsbach, stratospheric Welsbach seeding for reduction of global warming. And that patent actually goes back to older patents from 1965 and 1988. So it's obviously a project that's been in the works for some time.
Yeah, that is crazy that they might have been well aware of climate change. I mean, of course, leading scientists and the elite, they have information that we don't get sometimes ever. And it only makes sense that they would be worried about this stuff decades before the mainstream. And to think that that is kind of their attempt to lower the temperature is kind of crazy. I don't hear that much, but I agree with you that chemtrails don't seem like depopulation necessarily, because they're just not controlled enough. I mean, the elite would probably be poisoning themselves and their own families.
Right.
But
you get into the depopulation thing, right? The depopulation thing is actually very much more subversive. That if you want to look at depopulation, right, you look at the water supply.
Yeah.
In the water supply, there's actually, and whether it comes, extrude it, however it's getting in there, carelessness or by design, there's a large amount of birth control medications in there, estrogen, and what it's doing is it's lowering the birth rate. So in the West, the birth rate is plummeting, but in the third world, the birth rate is increasing. So what that tells you is that while the West, our birth rate in Europe and the United States and Canada and these developed countries, that, you know, we're losing population and unable to sustain it. In fact, at this point, every couple, right, would have to produce something like 2.2 children to actually level out the birth rate.
Huh.
So what I think is happening is you're seeing an overall depopulation through the boiling the frog method in the West,
right,
but they're letting the population increase in the third world and developing countries, because eventually they could use those as worker states.
Yeah, and you write about that a little bit too, and it makes total sense. I mean, another pressure valve on having kids in the West is economics and debt. I mean, we're under so much stress that a lot of people don't even want to think about having one, two, three kids. You know, I mean, our parents grew up with families that are a lot of times 8 to 12 kids, and it's like no one's doing that anymore. Who can afford to do that?
Right. Just having even a few kids, it's a massive change in your lifestyle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you would know. But in the book, you have a few lines about the International Monetary Fund. A lot of people in the conspiracy community talk about that. I mean, do you think one of their roles is monitoring this influx of populations and kind of trying to steer it in this direction using poverty as a weapon?
I do. I do. You know, Perkins and other people have exposed the IMF as an agent of change, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And what happens is you take a developing country and they're drowning in debt, and the IMF comes in and says, well, we'll bail you out, but here's the terms, right? You know, you've got to sell all your mineral rights to fill in the blank mineral company. You know, you have to buy weapons from these people, and you have to cede control basically of your government to us. And so then they can enforce values, whatever values they like, whether it's depopulation or overpopulation or changes to the tax code or whatever they want to do. The IMF can kind of has a heavy hand in that because they say, look, we'll just cut off the money.
Right. Yeah. It's a lot of power to have, man. Those are puppet masters right there, literally.
Literally. And one thing I did want to point out, that when we're looking at this whole thing, you know, you had made a comment about, you know, that the elites, whatever you want to call them, that they would know ahead of time, right? Mm-hmm. And there's a guy named Roger Revell, and he worked for Scripps. And I think it was in like 1955 or 1958, he was actually doing a study on phytoplankton. And he determined at that time in the late 50s that the plankton and these organisms in the ocean were only going to be able to handle 10% of the carbon dioxide and other damaging gases that were being released even then.
Huh.
So if they could only handle 10% of them in the late 50s, where are we at today?
Right. Yeah, exactly. No way to know. Leagues above that.
Right. And he published it. I mean, it's out there.
Right. And I mean, I've interviewed guys like Guy McPherson, who has a lot of compelling evidence. I mean, he seems to know what he's talking about. I mean, I had Michael Rupert on just weeks before that. And, you know, now he's committed suicide. He's seen the writing on the wall.
Right.
So there are those people out there still talking about it. It's just barely adopted in the mainstream. Everyone knows the term global warming, but it's just a buzzword. It doesn't seem to mean anything.
Well, it's changed from global warming to climate change.
Right.
And what's happened is that they've taken this field of study that has its good points and its bad points, and they've reduced it to a political argument.
Mm-hmm.
That I'm on this side of politics, so I have to say the party line is that global warming doesn't exist.
Yeah.
And, you know, whether there's a good saying that I heard once, whether the glass is half full or half empty, it's still dirty. So whether it's produced by us, it's a natural cycle, or some combination, it doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
It's still happening.
Yeah, that is exactly. Every time someone tries to get me in that argument, I'm like, it's just better to be cleaner. Who gives a shit about how bad it is exactly, how many years we have left, what caused it? Let's just be cleaner. Like, it's just kind of stupid to think that we should just trash the earth. And if it's not going to kill us, well, then it's fine to do.
Yeah, you know, let's get rid of the EPA and have nobody stopping us from dumping harmful chemicals into the ground that make us have all cancer and all kinds of side effects. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Just as human beings, right? I was a Boy Scout, and we had this motto that, you know, you go in, you leave it cleaner than you found it. Well, we're certainly not doing that.
Right. We need more Boy Scouts.
Well, I don't know about that, but, we definitely need to step back for a minute and say, you know what? Whatever's causing this, you know, we have a hand in trying to control it. You know, whether we've reached a tipping point or not, we have a hand in trying to make it better.
Absolutely.
And if it's a cycle, cycles come and go, but they do come back.
Right.
So, you know, we have to be ready.
Yeah, I agree with you, man. Well said. So getting back to the book a little bit, from there, there's the alternative two plan, which involves underground bases. Obviously, if we can't stop the climate from changing on the surface, the next thing to try would be massive underground facilities. And just like the ideas in phase one, I mean, we have plenty of evidence to be able to say that governments have built huge underground bases that are generally hidden from the public, right?
Correct. You know, you can look at Raven Rock, They're everywhere. Just do a search on continuity of government. You'll find just mountains of this stuff. And then, you look at other things like the Nordic seed vault, right? Here's this vault of non-genetically engineered seeds that's sitting up in the Arctic Circle, right? Mm-hmm. And I was shocked to find out when I was doing research that it's not the only one, that there are a number of these seed vaults all over the world.
Right, like little modern Noah's Arks.
Yeah, basically. And it's like, if you think that the surface of the earth is going to become scoured of vegetation, sticking seeds in a vault is probably a good idea.
Yeah, and if you don't, there's no reason to do that.
Right. That's my attitude.
Mm-hmm. But I love the conversations that I've had in the past with people like Richard Sauter, and also the stuff you have in the book about underground bases. It's just super mysterious and interesting to me that there could be something so crazy going on beneath our feet. I guess it's why I like the hollow earth theory also. But, obviously you can't fit everyone in these underground facilities. And obviously the elite find the masses to be pretty expendable. But I do like that you mentioned this number of 500 million people in this section, because I do hear it a lot in the conspiracy community that the elite want to get the population down to half a bill. And as you mentioned, it's kind of attached to Agenda 21 also. That's the number that those people throw out. And the Georgia Guidestones, which some people might not know about. I mean, can you give us some of the details on the Georgia Guidestones? Because they're pretty awesome, and it's a pretty big mystery from what I understand. I mean, what do we know about them?
It is. Well, there was a guy named Christensen that showed up in this town in Georgia one day. And he went to the bank and gave them a briefcase full of cash and said, I need you to help me build a monument. And so they built the monument out of, I think it was marble, and it's enormous. And, it has these, like, the laws of nature, and there's stuff like, it's all the tenets of the New World Order, right? You reduce the population of 500 million. I got to do this from memory. Live in harmony with the earth. It's something about let religion be controlled by reason, and a bunch of other ones. And they're actually translated into seven other languages. And then there are all these like celestial alignments.
Right. Really weird. It's kind of like a modern day Stonehenge, but
it is.
I did write down the languages. I mean, the message is written down in Hebrew, Egyptian, Russian, cuneiform, Spanish, Greek, Swahili, Sanskrit, Hindi, Arabic, and Chinese. And it's just so weird.
And then there's a message around the top. I forget what it says, but it's written in Egyptian, Babylonian, Greek, and Sanskrit.
Yeah. And I mean, some of the things I actually like, it's basically 10 things. And
I got it right here. Let all nations rule internally, resolving international disputes in a world court, balance personal rights with social duties, prize truth, beauty, love, seeking harmony with the infinite. Be not a cancer on the earth. Leave room for nature. Leave room for nature.
Yeah. And that's weird that they say that twice.
And then there's actually a key that they put as well. And it gives the astronomical alignments. Channel through stone indicates celestial pole. Horizontal slot indicates annual travel of the sun. Sunbeam through capstone marks noontime throughout the year. And then it was built by R.C. Christensen, the sponsors, a small group of Americans who seek the age of reason. And here's the interesting one. It says time capsule placed 6 feet below this spot on, and it was never completed to be opened on and never completed.
Yeah, that is a weird aspect to it.
It's a weird place. I mean, it's right off the road, and it's surrounded by roses, and it has like a lawn, and you just kind of show up, and it's maintained. And I guess part of the money that was left was left in perpetuity to maintain it. But the banker who actually knew who R.C. Christian was, he refuses to tell anybody.
Yeah, so strange. And there's also a Masonic time capsule at the Denver airport, which, of course, people think is probably got a huge underground base there.
Right.
And I know we've talked about that one before, and we kind of talked about how it's probably too blown up and has gotten too much press for it to really be useful for anybody. But one that you wrote about that I hadn't heard was this site R, Apparently it has like a 10-year supply of coffee.
Yeah, so Raven Rock.
Right.
So, yeah, Raven Rock is like the alternative Pentagon. And it has, not only does it have a Starbucks, but it also has a gift shop.
Nice.
It's huge. It's truly massive. And you know what's funny is that one of the things that comes along with these secret underground bases is this notion that there's a underground rail network that connects them.
Right.
And that goes back way back into the 80s. And what's interesting is if you look at it, in the 70s, the Rand Corporation, who's a think tank, they had actually published a study showing that they could build these high-speed underground networks in the 70s using a kind of pressure thing. And they could go like coast to coast in like 3 hours or something. It was crazy.
Wow.
Yeah, so man. So Elon Musk is about 30 years late.
Yeah, even Jacques Fresco in the Venus Project, he talks about using that technology, and that's probably where I had first heard about it. And then to hear that this stuff might be older than me is just kind of shocking. But in terms of these underground bases, man, do you think that they're made, I mean, they're probably multi-purpose, of course, but do you think they're really for the elite in case of global disaster, or do you think they're more for secret underground, like testing of technologies and experiments, that kind of stuff?
No, I think that those bases in particular, like SITAR and some of the others, those are what are called continuity of government facilities. And those are designed for, ostensibly, they were designed that in the event of a nuclear war, right, that they could move everybody, the Congress, the President, and Joint Chiefs and everybody, the command and control elements of our government, they could move it underground and continue to fight the war from underground, right? But the reality is that, you know, that's kind of a losing proposition. Mm-hmm. But in mastering that technique and mastering that capability, the bunkers also serve as a place to go in case of something like climate change, where if they want to go subsurface, there are a number of these facilities scattered around the world where they can go and hide.
Yeah. And I hear go ahead.
But what I was going to say is what's more interesting is that, you know, you can only save a very, very small percentage of the population by moving underground. I mean, the bases are just not big enough. You can't build underground cities large enough to house everybody in LA. Right. So, you know, with this rise of the idea of these FEMA camps and this other stuff, I think those might be elements that are surface based that are designed to control the population as the others descend.
Yeah, those FEMA camps, man, they're creepy. Anyone who's really looked at the videos of them or seen the tens of thousands of plastic coffins they store, it is weird. But, I mean, maybe they don't even know what they're planning for. They just might see the writing on the wall that eventually, whether it's economic or environmental, there's going to be a disaster, and they don't want to have to deal with us when we get angry.
Well, it's simpler than that. You know, they probably fundamentally don't know what they're for. It's somebody in the food chain somewhere said, you got to go build it. Mm-hmm. That's how these things work, right? Let's say that you're building an exotic aircraft. You know, you're going to have three groups of people working on the engine, and each one is working on a different component of the engine. Only at the very end, when a technician puts the engine together, that guy is the only guy who actually knows what the engine does.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. And it just, man, it does piss me off, though, that all government runs on the people's money, and yet they put more energy into these contingency plans to control us or to keep us down in some type of collapse or disaster situation, or build multi-billion dollar facilities for themselves underground just in case. Meanwhile, people are starving on the surface, and rather than putting any energy into using the people's money to improve life today, it's just all spent for the potential for disaster and the lives of a few.
But they can.
Right. I mean, who's stopping them? No one seems to give a shit. We're all just going to work and watching Big Bang Theory.
You know, we sit around and we complain about it. And we say, look, this is terrible. This is awful. Yes, but we elect these people and put them in there.
That's true.
I mean, you know, sometimes I get into trouble when I do the politics thing. But this is the way I see it, right? Whether you're on the right or you're on the left, it doesn't really matter.
No.
At the end of the day, the people that we are paying and sending up there, they're in it for themselves. I mean, lost is the day that Mr. Smith went to Washington. Mm-hmm. There are very few Mr. Smiths in Washington now. Mm-hmm. They're bought and paid for, whether they're on the right or the left or the Tea Party or not. They're all bought and paid for by special interest groups. I mean, the idea that they can pass a ruling that says that a company is a person.
Yeah.
A company has all the rights of a person. That's asinine.
Right.
You know, does that mean that fill in the blank multinational corporation like Viacom is going to have children? Apparently, yeah. Viacom has the right to adopt children. I don't know if Sumner Redstone wants to do that, but apparently Viacom as an entity has the right to get married.
Yeah, it's so stupid, the legal framework for that stuff. There was one guy fighting back in an interesting way out here in California that was... he was trying to make the case that he's allowed to drive in the carpool lane, which anyone who has a carpool lane should know. They're just so great to get into. And he thought he should be able to drive in it because he had his corporate paperwork and his passenger seat. And if a corporation is a person, then this is basically the corporation in this manila envelope, and we're riding together. So fuck you.
I heard about that.
I think that's funny, but I mean, obviously there are way more serious ramifications for corporate personhood than the carpool lane, but it is just asinine that goes on. But I was going to mention to you, man, on the subject of underground bases, when I spoke with David Politis a few episodes ago, I mentioned your article for Paranoia that talked about batch consignments and how these clusters of disappearances from David Politis's work are actually pretty close to the apparent places that a lot of underground bases are. So I did mention that to him, and he said he's heard the theory, but he thinks that some of the areas are too remote or that too many people are actually found later dead or alive, so they're not actually, you know, missing. But I still think it's a super interesting theory, and it's weird that there is that connection. They do overlay. They are pretty damn close.
They are, and I think David Politis does an amazing job. You know, he does some of the best research I've ever seen. And, you know, for my money, you know, whether they find them alive or dead later, you still don't know what happened to them in between.
Good point.
Because one of the things that he points out is that when these people are found days or weeks later, they have no idea where they've been.
Yeah, maybe they're hitting them with that Men in Black flashbulb thing and sending right. them back out in the woods.
Or maybe they flunked the test. Who knows? But, yeah. You know, there are large numbers of people that disappear around these bases. And whether they become batch consignments or whether they are tested or whatever's going on, there are large numbers that seem to correspond to these bases that exist.
Yeah, man. And on the I wanted to double back to the half a billion number, the 500 million number, because it's also part of Agenda 21. And someone who's kind of new to conspiracy might not have heard about it because I feel like it's kind of died down. It was a pretty big thing several years ago. But I think the problem is that the people talking about it put a year on it. I think they put like 2010 or 2011 as the year for it, that all these vitamins were going to get basically taken off the market, and it was going to become a prescription thing only for you to get vitamins and nutrients. So they were going to choke us out that way. But what are your thoughts on Agenda 21?
Well, you know, Agenda 21 is this UN program to create sustainable populations, right? So the UN idea is, you know, you want to put things into place and control, you know, the production of food and the distribution of food. And, you know, when I look at this stuff, you know, in a lot of ways, it's actually the problem of conspiracy theory, right? That when, as conspiracy theorists, the best we can be in 9 times out of 10 is a theorist, right?
Right.
We see the outliers. You know, we see the symptoms, but we never see the problem, mm-hmm. right? You know, you might have a viral infection that manifests by having a little tiny purple dot on your back, right?
Yeah.
We can find the purple dot and say, well, that's a purple dot. And that purple dot means that you're sick. But we can never extrapolate it and say, well, that purple dot means that you have this particular viral infection. Mm-hmm. And so when you look at things like Agenda 21, and it's not the first or last time that they're going to do something like that, when you look at Agenda 21, it's an outlier. of a mechanism that they're using to control populations, to control food distribution, to control power generation. I think all those elements are in there.
Yeah.
And it's just another way that they're trying to do it. So, you know, what I think happens is you get a lot of people who are wrapped around the axle about it, you know, Agenda 21, and Agenda 21 becomes a buzzword. But what they're not doing is they're not going deeper. And they're not saying, well, why does Agenda 21 exist?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think the better conversation is not so much Agenda 21. Maybe they'll do it. Maybe they won't. Maybe it's in 2015. Maybe it's in 2090. I don't know. But what I can tell you is that as an entity, the object of Agenda 21 is one element of a population control system that is actually much bigger than just Agenda 21.
Well said. You're right. Yeah. It's a multi-pronged, multifaceted, quote-unquote, attack if you're in the camp that thinks that this is nefarious. But, you know, a lot of people also would just say that, of course, there's going to be monitoring of the planet. I mean, there has to be. You know, somebody's got to be out there doing it. But they do it in such secrecy, and they only care about themselves. So it's just a lot of power for someone to have.
But it's also only really feasible to monitor in the West.
Yeah.
Because we have the infrastructure to allow laws to be passed or to controls to be put in place. You get into places with less infrastructure and things like programs like Agenda 21 start to break down.
Yeah.
So, you know, I go back to my statement that things like Agenda 21 or the depopulation meme in general, you know, they're only feasible in the West.
Right.
They're only feasible in Russia or Europe or North America, you know, elements of Central and South America, certain countries in Africa, Asia, these places where the infrastructure exists, like the Chinese for decades have had the, you know, one child rule, mm-hmm. right? Because the Chinese have the infrastructure to put that kind of population control in place.
Yeah.
I mean, it's an authoritarian autocratic kind of a place, but you know, they can do it because they have that control.
Yeah. Scary stuff, man. And to bring it up to alternative three, you know, in terms of these different agendas, I mean, we've walked through the first ones and the second one. Clearly they've tried to do these things that were apparently just part of this mockumentary that was made by some people who just wanted to make some entertainment, but yet we're seeing these things have happened. And the big alternative three, you know, when geoengineering doesn't work and your underground bases aren't cutting it, the last option is to go off planet. So, I mean, how far would you say we are on this? I mean, there's a lot of speculation when we have moon bases or Mars bases. Do you find that to be within reason?
I do. Back in the late 50s, the military, the Army, and the Air Force came up with divergent plans to put military installations on the moon. I think the Army was Horizon and the Air Force was Lunex. But, you know, they both predicted that by the early 60s, they would be operational.
Yeah.
So I don't see any kind of a problem with us having bases on the moon. And if you look at the moon and you look at some of the photography that's come back from the moon, there's some weird stuff up there. You know, I put some of the photos into the book.
Right.
But there are tracks. There's garbage. I mean, we're not a very clean group of people. So, you know, don't look for the base. Look for the trash.
Right.
And so there's trash there.
It is weird. I mean, sometimes I can't tell what I'm looking at in those things, but there are a few pictures that are pretty compelling.
Well, there's one in particular on Mars that I call the facility, and it's amazing. I mean, if you've seen it, nobody can tell me that that's not artificial. I mean, it's basically cut into the side of a cliff, and it's perfectly smooth, and it's angular, and it sticks out like a sore thumb. I mean, most of the time when I show that picture to people, they kind of look at it twice and go, "Are you sure that's on Mars?" And I'm like, absolutely, it's on Mars. I mean, I'm looking at it right now, and it kind of looks like a very expensive house in Malibu.
That's awesome, man. I'd love to think that's happening.
Well, yes and no, because if you make the leap of faith and say, well, you know what, we've got stuff on the moon and Mars, then you know you have to go backwards and say, well, why do we have it there?
Right.
And that opens up a can of worms. And then, you know, your worldview changes. And, well, how much time do I have on this rock, you know?
Right, before we have to get to the new one, if we're even allowed in some Elysium-type situation.
I don't think I'm invited.
Yeah, me either, man. You never fail to impress, dude. Always fascinating stuff. It's been a real pleasure getting to talk to you again. I'm glad that you have a new book out. I know it's not easy to write a whole book from beginning to end, and you have accomplished it. And you want to remind people on where they can pick it up and maybe your website and other stuff you got going on?
Sure. It's called The Secret Space Age. You can get it on Amazon, or you can buy it on my website at anomalies.net, anomalies.net. I also contributed to a book put out by Tim Beckley, a conspiracy journal called The Ark of the Covenant and Other Ancient Mysterious Weapons. I think that's what it's called. I wrote a section on weaponry in ancient India. So, you know, pick that up too. You can get to that through my website, anomalies, anomalies.net, or you can go to conspiracyjournal.com.
Very cool. Well, Olav, man, you are the best. Maybe someday we'll get a UFO with a swastika bumper sticker on it and you'll be validated once and for all.
I hope we don't. Want to be wrong.
Fair. It'll be a bittersweet moment, but until that day, man, take care of yourself, all right?
Hey, you too.
Well, there we have it, Higher Side Chatters. One of my favorite guys to talk conspiracy with, Olav Phillips, dishing out a healthy dose of education and a generous side portion of speculation. Helps the medicine go down. That's what Mary Poppins was talking about. I think most of the big conspiratorial themes of the last decades fit pretty nicely with the programs outlined in the Alternative 3 mockumentary. Looking back now, it is way more obvious that all these plans have been tested and carried out in some fashion since then, and there might have been some very curious government agents who wondered just how these TV show guys got so close to the mark. It's interesting stuff. And in the Plus show, we went from the Alternative 3 programs to discussing Olav's longtime position that after World War II, the Nazis might have made it from Argentina to Antarctica, and then quite possibly off-planet, and maybe this well-kept secret is the reason for such militarization of space, and some of the strange crafts we find, and the abduction phenomenon. It's definitely an alternative to the mainstream ideas, and I think Olav makes some really good points and a really strong case about the iconography of these crashed UFOs, what might have happened with the moon landing, the reason why NASA is being defunded, suspicious aspects of the Benny and Barney Hill abduction case, and a lot of other bits and pieces that might support that idea. We also talk about Valiant Thor and the supposed ET from Venus that worked with the government, Operation Gladio, the Nazi Bell, and the Germans' fascination with all things occult, what benefits this might have had from them in the ways of exotic technologies, and their well-established but little-known plan to systematically wipe out all the Masons. It is an interesting second half, so consider joining me for it by subscribing at thehiresidechatsplus.com. And if you can't or don't want to, thank someone who does, because it's the Plus subscribers that allow me to continue putting out free shows for everyone else. Please share and review the show where you can. That helps as well. I also sell t-shirts that ironically put down capitalism, as well as some that comment on MKUltra, militarized police, UFOs building the pyramids, all sorts of bold designs for these troubled times at conspiracies.net. So check those out if the power of Christ compels you. And of course, it's good to be informed of the covert and sometimes subtle plan to drive a wedge between the elite and the rest of the world. But don't let that be your excuse for not enjoying the life you came here to enjoy. If you believe the guys who say you choose the life you have for a reason before you manifest here, well, that also includes this time. So shake off the amnesia and realize you chose the tipping point for a reason. And let's stop dumping those buckets of ice water on our heads and instead provide some ice water for the neighbors around us who can't. See, the ALS Association gets a 4 out of 4 star rating by Charity Navigator, which is probably the most well-respected gauge for which charities are worth donating to. So ALS gets a 90%, a 4 out of 4 star rating. But if you scroll down to compensation, the president and CEO makes $340,000 a year. Well, I'm fucking sorry, but that is not a 4 out of 4 to me. And another very important point. When I see a charity that's to support the research to find a cure for X, Y, or Z, I know it's a waste of money because our medical and pharmaceutical industries suppress cures in exchange for expensive long-term treatments. There are no cures. When was the last cure you heard of? I hear of a ton of treatments, lifelong injections for diabetes or HIV, or the torturous chemo plans for cancer victims, but no cures. So you might as well burn your money if you're not going to overthrow the entire rigged system. Because you'll spend infinite amounts of money getting no cures because the core problem isn't being addressed. And this comes out to a larger point where lately I've been taking some heat for being critical of the way protesters and activists carry out their activities. And that's just because I see it as so rare to get people to actually care. It's so hard for something positive to take hold and make real change that I want to see people doing it a little bit smarter or more effectively. I don't know, just some unrelated topics off the top of my head. I suggested that instead of blocking highways in Missouri to draw awareness to the Ferguson issue, they should go to the police station and block the cars from getting out of the lot. You know, dump all the neighborhood trash on the police station lawn. I don't care, but you should be focusing your outrage at the police, and it should be obvious. Blocking a highway is not going to get the locals on your side. I'm sorry, people shouldn't be selfish. People should care more about these issues, but you can't inconvenience them, at least not in America. We all want good things. I just think we're going to have to dial in on things a little more vigilantly to have them be meaningful and lasting. But I guess that's it for me. Do what you love doing the way you love to do it. Hang out with people who make your life better. And more importantly, be someone who makes the lives around yourself better, and we can turn this crazy bitch around despite chemtrails and Agenda 21 and the goddamn IMF. So that's it for me, people. I'll see you in a few short days. Until then, it's your move, power brokers of this broken planet. Your fucking move.
This is not the future we were promised. Sure.